Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back for another COVID-19 podcast because basically, why the hell not at this point? So we are going to talk a little more about something that has been coming up more because more people are talking about trying to get back to the quote-unquote normal. I say it that way because I'm not sure what normal is going to look like in the end, but we understand that we must come back to something. And I don't disagree with that. And I would love for us to go back to the way things were, well, at least parts of it. I like politics to be not as aggressive, but that's a different story for a different day. But what I would like to see more of is how are we going to actually do this? Because a lot of people are talking about quote-unquote reopening, and reopening, in a sense, is going to be one of those things that is going to be the most challenging because right now, we are seeing a drop, and a lot of this is thanks to the measures that are currently in place. The fact that we are social distancing and we are using isolation, we are finally getting to the point where we are starting to get to testing where we need it, although we still have quite a ways to go, and trying to just get ahead of this. And so when we talk about reopening, me personally, I get nervous about this, not because I am afraid or terrified in a sense of the actual infection and me getting it. I recognize the fact there's a really good chance that I personally will get infected at some point. What I worry about is the spread, especially with how many people are asymptomatic. And this is something we're going to talk about here in just a few minutes. But then all these cases all of a sudden surging. And we talk about this in other frames of reference, and we've had comparisons before, we've had discussions before about this, we've talked about how this in some ways compares to the 1918 flu pandemic, and all of this is very real. All of this is something that we have to keep in mind. But at the same time, I recognize and I realize and I want us to be able to go back and be able to start opening stores up and start being able to do more things than what we've been doing for, in some cases, the last couple of months. But many of us in maybe the more rural areas and the areas not as heavily affected, you know, we've been doing this for maybe a month or so. And we will probably look back at this just like I'm thinking people are going to look back at these podcasts later. So if you're listening to this later, I apologize for all the COVID-19 podcasts. But at the same time, I don't, because I think this is a huge part of something we need to look back at as a society and as history goes. Because something that I have found personally so challenging with this is because we don't have a single great precedent, especially in our lifetimes. Because realistically, we don't have many, if any, people left alive who can recall the details of the 1918 flu pandemic. And we also don't have a time in history, at least here in the United States, where we have needed to do the measures that are currently in place, where we needed to have people stay at home and stay at home for a prolonged period of time. Also dealing with the disease that we really don't know what's going on, how best to treat it to such a degree such as this. I mean, the closest we come to in that case would be HIV/AIDS and the early pandemic that came with it. We also have these mass graves that are occurring in the United States in heavily affected areas, mainly New York City, which is, again, something that we haven't experienced in our lifetimes in the United States. Now, given it has happened before in the United States, and it happens in other parts of the world. But I can't think of personally a time when we needed to do mass graves across the country for stuff like this. I just can't. But I think we have to recognize the fact that we do have to go back to something, some form of that quote-unquote normal. And I'm not someone who is an economist, and so I can't vouch for that side. I mean, obviously, we can see the economic impacts, and I recognize that. But at the same time, I'm seeing this from the healthcare side and wanting to do what is best for us to safely return to our lives and getting things back on track. But at the same time, how do we do this best? And so this is where the podcast comes in today. This is where everything's leading up to. And that's talking about screening protocols. Because most likely, you work at a healthcare facility or have been to a healthcare facility where there is a screening process going on. And as a result, this often happens on location, but sometimes it can happen over the phone or in some form or fashion prior to you coming there. And the reason why we screen is because we are trying to use this to help identify the people who are sick and isolate them, keep them separate from those who are healthy. As we're noticing, though, with COVID-19, this is extremely challenging because there's a very high prevalence of asymptomatic patients. And as a result, even though you're asymptomatic, there is a real concern of you helping spread the virus. And so how do we do this? How do we effectively screen for people who are asymptomatic? And we could talk about testing. We'll talk about that more towards the end. But let's talk a little bit first about some of the evidence about why screening protocols are not going to be effective in and of themselves. So just asking people questions of, do you have a fever? Do you have cough? Stuff like that. And for those of you who are living this day to day, this is not going to be a surprise because you are probably in the same boat I am, where you see these people, you think, you probably have it, but either I can't test for it, or in the places that are fortunate enough to have the testing where they can do this for asymptomatic people, we are finding wildly higher rates than we would have anticipated in, say, other diseases. One caveat, one thing I want to make sure to mention at the beginning of this, because it's something that we are noticing more with COVID-19 literature in general, is that not everything we're talking about, and even some of maybe the previous studies, I have to go back and double check, but I believe I had only published up to this point and added studies up to this point that were formally peer-reviewed. But we're getting to the point of this where there's so much research, so much literature out there that the journals cannot keep up with this. And so there is an ethical dilemma. Do you give out research that has not been formally peer-reviewed yet with the understanding that this has some limitations as to its validity? The good news is that through different services, we are still having a form of peer review. Even this can be argued as a form of peer review by actually looking at the articles, reading them, and then discussing them, both good and bad. That is still a form of peer review. But when you have content experts who go through this and check the different things, and then you still have the stage of the rest of us online or through other forms of media, being able to research and review this and help provide that extra layer of peer review that isn't just found in the journals is nice. But in this case, we have to rely on kind of the online presence and people who know how to actually research and understand things. So with that in mind, just understand that a couple of things we're going to talk about have not been formally peer-reviewed yet, but it has been widely discussed in the medical community. And it seems like there's an overall consensus with this, but I would highly encourage, even more than usual, to read these articles yourself so that way you can have a better idea and be skeptical with what's being discussed, just like I would encourage you for anything that you're coming across. And this is where sometimes it's hard because people like myself, who in some ways may be experts or at least more proficient in the knowledge than the average person, will admit that they don't know everything and recognize their own limitations, but people want assurances, they want definites, they want absolutes. But I'd highly encourage with something like this, you cannot rely on the absolutes. Think more and listen more to the people who are less definite in their answers because they are more likely to have your thoughts legitimately in mind and what is going to be your best interests in mind. Okay, enough with that. Let's actually dive into some of the data that we're using to help reflect why maybe screening protocols are not going to be effective enough in of themselves. And the first one that we're going to talk about is from the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's regarding a cohort of pregnant patients that delivered at two New York hospitals. They were all screened on admission for symptoms. And out of the 210 women that were tested, 33 were positive for SARS-CoV-2. And that's the virus that causes COVID-19, in case you forgot with all the vernacular that's going on. But only 4 of those 33 women tested positive had symptoms. So that means that 87.9%, or about 88% of patients, were asymptomatic. That's significant. That's rather large. Now, we have to keep in mind that the overall prevalence may be higher simply because of the geographic region. Okay, that's fair. We're talking about New York, and New York is obviously hard hit. But we also have to remember that there are serious concerns of false negatives. So if we were testing all these people and 88% were asymptomatic, and we know that a certain amount of people have false negatives, could this number have moved one way or another? Because there may have been some symptomatic people that tested negative but could have had it, and vice versa. So just keep that in mind as we are talking about this. But the false negatives, I think we've talked a little bit about before. If not, just remind me and we can have another post about that if that's what you want. But I think this has been discussed about quite a bit before. But again, 88% of people were asymptomatic, a very large number. We're seeing a lot of studies coming out with the roughly 80s percent. In fact, let's talk about a whole different population together that has the same issue. A homeless shelter in Boston had tested 408 individuals, so basically everyone in the shelter, for which 147 tested positive for the virus. That's a pretty high number, but given these are people who are more at risk, and so maybe that is why there's such high prevalence. But here's where it becomes interesting. Again, we are checking for symptoms. And with the last one, it doesn't really specify a whole ton about what those symptoms were. It's just basically that there were symptoms. But with this Boston homeless shelter, they specified that symptoms they were looking for were cough, shortness of breath, diarrhea, or fever. Out of the 147 that were tested positive, 121, or 82.3%, had no symptoms. None of the symptoms that they were using as part of the screening, which, again, these are very common ones. And I would argue that even with the diarrhea part, that's not something that's being asked in a lot of healthcare settings. I think we focus more on the fever, cough, shortness of breath. So with that in mind, there's quite a few people who are asymptomatic in this case. Now, the concern is that this is a shelter, and there is risk for very rapid spread throughout this population. And this becomes even more concerning because this is an at-risk population for a number of reasons, including the fact that many of these people lack insurance, they have comorbidities that are often not being managed or poorly managed, and they are in close proximity. So it spreads very quickly, which means that they are exposed to a heavy viral load, they're more likely to get sick and maybe more severely sick. And because of the sheer numbers involved, more people are likely to need to go to the hospital, you're having higher rates of death, and so on. Let's go overseas for a moment, just for a comparison's sake, because this has a little bit of different research. This, again, comes from the New England Journal of Medicine, and this is a study out of Iceland. They had a couple of different phases for which they basically tested people and on different criteria, and then they got results from it to see who was positive, who wasn't for SARS-CoV-2. The targeted population focused on those who were at high risk, including those who were symptomatic, had recently traveled to high-risk countries, or had contact with someone who was infected. They also then had an open invitation period and a random invitation period. And those were, again, more people who were not at high risk, more of your general population. 13.3% of the targeted population tested positive for the virus, 0.8% in an open invitation population, and then 0.6% in the random invitation population. What is most interesting is that while 93% of those in the targeted population tested positive, only 57% had symptoms in the overall populations, so the open and random populations, which again means that over half of the people who do have the virus had no symptoms, and another concerning finding that we must consider. I know some of you may be thinking, well, I was sick earlier this year, or maybe you're sick all the way back in November or December. But maybe earlier this year you were sick, or you saw a bunch of people who were sick with flu-like symptoms. I remember thinking this myself for a little bit of time when we saw a bunch of people who were flu negative, but were sick. In fact, some of them required critical care and intubation, and they didn't do well. And it made me think, okay, maybe we saw this before. Maybe this is something that was going on. And I asked some of my colleagues who have viral respiratory panels and had other testing that we didn't have in my local community, and found a variety of viruses that they were seeing. But again, none of us could test for SARS-CoV-2 at that time. So we couldn't do the COVID-19 testing that we are now able to do. However, a study out of California is able to suggest otherwise, to suggest that we most likely did not see a bunch of patients with COVID-19. In some ways, this is convenient because some of the media recently around herd immunity and this idea of the virus having already been there comes from the same parts of California as the study was performed. However, the study does suggest otherwise, as the unadjusted prevalence of antibodies to SARS-CoV-2 in that area was 1.5%, and the population-weighted prevalence was 2.8%. So even if you adjust for the population, how many people had the virus and had antibodies to it, it was less than 3%. While the researchers do accurately point out that this does mean that there is a much higher rate of cases than are being confirmed by lab testing at this point, it really implies more that those who were sick earlier this year did not have it. And even if they did, which again, highly doubt because of the fact that there are so few people with the antibodies out there, this less than 3% of the population is way too low for any herd immunity that I'm aware of. When you're talking about herd immunity, you're talking about much higher percentages. So for example, when we're talking about measles, we need 95% of the population to have the vaccine and have the antibodies needed so that way you can achieve herd immunity. And so when you have less than that, you really can't sufficiently provide herd immunity. And so when you're talking about numbers as low as this, like I said, at this point, you have to do something else. You may be asking yourself now, okay, well, we can't do screening protocols effectively, so we can't just ask people questions and help isolate them that way. We don't have enough tests to test every single person right now, whether that's by antibody or by swabs. And even when we test people who may have been exposed, and when we also look at our overall populations, the numbers are just too low to where we don't have herd immunity at this point. So what do we do moving forward? This is the most challenging part because I don't have an answer for you. I wish I did. I have some thoughts in general about it, but nothing really solid. So this is what concerns me, is because if we don't really have a very strong answer as far as what to do that's going to be safe, we can't push for opening the doors too early. My mindset behind this is similar to what other people have. It's hard to know what's going to be the safest approach, but a lot of people are talking about this quote-unquote soft reopening or something similar along those lines. And what they're trying to say is that basically you open up certain locations, certain stores, and certain places. So geographic regions that are maybe not heavily affected and who have an overall low prevalence, opening up some things then and allowing the economy and people in general to get back on track, which I can understand, but we have to recognize that we don't have herd immunity yet. So you're going to be exposing people. Well, which people do you expose? Most people are arguing that you leave it up to those who are the healthiest because they're at the lowest risk, which is overall true. Most people who have bad outcomes are people who have comorbidities, but not in all cases. And if you release these people, how do you define healthy, and who gets to decide who's healthy and who's not? I think that's something else, because I think you'll find a lot of people who do have comorbidities, whether or not they feel like they're well managed, will want to get out too. And also, even if you have all the people stay at home, you know, the people who would have the comorbidities stay at home, how do you get services to them? Is it the healthy people that are going to bring those services with them? Because if so, remember, a large percentage of the people with the virus are asymptomatic. We're talking about up to 88%, at least in the studies that we looked at today. If we have this high prevalence overall, and we have people who are healthy, so they're more likely to also be the ones who are asymptomatic, at least in theory, then we are talking about spreading it even more quickly to those who are most prone to it because, again, we're trying to deliver services to them, or we're trying to do things for them, we're trying to open everything back up, and I worry about this strategy. I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just not sure how best to do it. And especially since we don't have enough PPE, even for the healthcare providers, how do we have enough PPE to then give and teach them properly how to use it to the overall population? We also don't have a vaccine that's ready yet, and we don't have a definite treatment yet. So with all this in mind, I find this really challenging as far as how to do this best. And like I said, I hope someone comes up with something very clever and that it's safe and effective. I want this to work, and I am optimistic that we will find a solution. But I bring all this up today with this podcast is because I don't feel like screening protocols are going to be enough, and that we haven't had enough of the population overall yet to develop a herd immunity. And so whatever step we have moving forward is that I think we have to keep those pieces of evidence in mind as we move forward and try to make a decision. All right, so that pretty much wraps this podcast up. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope this provides you with some more information. Like I said, I'm not trying to make this at all political, and I feel like I've done a pretty good job keeping the politics out of it because I think we all are on the same page of we want to get back to some form of normalcy. It's just that the thoughts and how to do this, I think, differ with individuals, and I accept and appreciate that. And I've had some really good discussions recently about this as well, and I feel like we've had very good dialogue. But I think we need to continue doing that moving forward until we find the best solution, and to make sure that what we're doing is going to be safe for the population, doesn't overwhelm healthcare, is able to help restore the economy and people's livelihoods as quickly as possible. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.